This is Hacker Daily for Tuesday, April 24th, 2018. Today we're covering a device that can control your dreams. Is now the perfect time for an RSS renaissance? Blockchain, what is it good for? The evolution of windmills? Is Google the next company in the privacy hot seat? How artificial intelligence is helping scientists discover new materials? And finally, did you know that 2018 is already 30% over? If you had this new app, you would. I'm Dave Zorub.
And I'm Harish Agarwal.
Thanks for tuning in to Hacker Daily, featuring top stories for hackers, founders, and makers. Don't forget to subscribe and rate us on your podcast app. Thanks for listening.
Vice reports that MIT researchers have developed a system for dream control. While the headline is blown out of proportion in typical clickbait fashion, the article explores very interesting research being conducted at the edges of our understanding of sleep. Adam Horowitz, a researcher at the MIT Media Lab, is examining a state of consciousness dubbed hypnagogia. Hypnagogia occurs at the transition between wakefulness and deep sleep. It's during this state of consciousness that many people experience hallucinations and lucid dreaming. It's also a state of consciousness which many famous thinkers, from Thomas Edison to Salvador Dali, have coveted, believing that it encourages a burst of creativity. Edison was known to have encouraged hypnagogia by falling asleep, holding steel balls in one hand. As he entered deep sleep and his grip loosened, the steel balls would fall, making a clanging sound. Allegedly, this sound would transition Edison to hypnagogia. Horowitz's research has focused on creating a device which reproduces Edison's steel ball effect. The device, called Dormio, uses sensors which monitor muscle tone and other signals such as heart rate to detect when a user is falling asleep. As the user falls asleep, a smartphone app is triggered to play a pre-programmed phrase. The phrase is both meant to trigger hypnagogia, like Edison's steel balls, and plant a seed for the connections made during hypnagogia, a la the movie Inception. Early results from Horowitz's research are promising, showing an improvement in creativity, as measured by the alternative uses task, as well as some confirmation that the Inception phrase is working. However, the study so far has only been conducted on 15 participants. Horowitz has plans to iterate on the study by conducting the research on many more human subjects and making Dormio less intrusive. Until then, you'll have to make do with steel balls and a spinning top to monitor your states of hypnagogia.
Is now the perfect time for an RSS renaissance? Nefarious Laboratories, a data security firm in Massachusetts, wrote a mini manifesto about how the technology could be the perfect antidote to the privacy problems we're seeing with Facebook, Google, and others. As a quick refresher, RSS is a technology that lets websites and applications publish a feed of recent updates. It's been around since 1999, though the current standard was created by longtime blogger Dave Weiner and dates to 2002. Nefarious Laboratories CEO Ethan Grant writes, "The very idea of RSS, obtaining content from a website without having to visit the site itself, is due for a comeback. No ads. No suspicious JavaScript. Just the signal without the noise. It's not perfect privacy, but it's one step back and two steps forward in the right direction." Commenter Original Simba had a popular, but in my mind, deeply conspiratorial take on Hacker News, writing, quote, "Did anyone else notice how corporations like Twitter and Facebook quietly tried to kill RSS in the past 10 years? RSS is a wonderful technology which embodies the spirit of the internet. Facebook and Twitter are, by comparison, cancer." End quote. Now that's some hyperbole right there. I have some experience here. I started an RSS startup back in 2007 called Reader, R-E-A-D-R, like Flickr, because names like Flickr were popular at the time. We wanted to build an RSS reader for people who didn't know about RSS. So you'd attach your social feeds, like photos from Flickr, bookmarks from Delicious, Twitter status updates, stuff like that, and your friends would attach theirs, and then we'd give you a news feed of what your friends were up to all around the web. Kind of like what the Facebook news feed ended up becoming. In my experience, RSS is one of those technologies that's always had a lot of promise, but it's floundered when it's marketed directly to consumers. Most RSS products that are marketed as RSS products fail. Google Reader was a popular one that the company shut down a few years ago. Dig, the social news site, created a replacement that was also popular, but then they shut it down too. There are a few popular readers still alive and well today, like Feedly, but the list of dead RSS apps is way longer than the list of alive ones. Yet, RSS is already powering the podcast ecosystem, which has grown exponentially in popularity over the last few years. Every podcast has an RSS feed, and that's how podcast apps like Apple's power their podcast directories. So, clearly the technology is useful at scale. Is now the time for an RSS renaissance? Well, we may already be in one. We're just not calling it RSS, just like we don't name other applications by the protocols that power them. Nobody calls Gmail an SMTP client or Safari an HTTP client. They're just email clients and web browsers. So I'd argue the renaissance may already be happening.
Clemens Vasters, a distributed systems software architect at Microsoft Azure, wrote, "A blockchain is a specific set of choices suitable for a narrow set of use cases in a tweet storm." In Vasters' view, blockchain technology is combining well-understood techniques from distributed computing to serve a specific use case. He writes, "The blockchain-specific consensus models are tailored to A, an all-around lack of trust, and B, convergence to a singular global log." The innovation, according to Vasters, is that it literally trades trust for time. It's slow by design. He adds, "Convergence to a singular global log with many candidate writers and many replicas makes it hard to reach consensus, and for that consensus to be propagated. Proof of work, or proof of work plus proof of stake, cleverly solve that by being intentionally slow." He contrasts the consensus algorithms used by blockchain with how the financial industry works today. He points out that the existing banking system is already somewhat decentralized. There are 15,000 plus banks which each maintain ledgers and come to a consensus to conduct transactions. The difference? The banking system solves the trust issue by requiring a banking license and an audit in the local jurisdiction to be a bank. As Vasters writes, once there's a trusted neutral party, that trusted neutral party can already establish non-repudiation by forcing authentication and authorization, along with a content signature, and only ever allowing appends, with any regular old database that the neutral party maintains. The conclusion Vasters draws is that the specific combination of well-understood architectural building blocks that make up blockchain is very well applicable, but nearly exclusively applicable, to all-around trustless global ledger accounting problems, for example, coins. While blockchain has an increasing share of both true believers and perennial skeptics, it's fascinating to read the opinion of a technical expert in distributed computing. Vasters is not disputing the utility of blockchain. He's just saying that it only applies in a small set of use cases and is really just a combination of well-established distributed computing techniques. This doesn't strike me as a dismissive evaluation. Many new technologies are a simple reframing of existing ideas. It does, however, seem to be a very pragmatic view of a technology which has captured the imagination of the world. A Hacker News commenter wrote about a conference he recently attended, saying, "I was surprised at how blockchain was being touted as the next technological revolution, and was concerned at how quickly the other attendees accepted blockchain as it was being sold. It will not be long before a large number of software projects will be based on blockchain needlessly, and engineers will be arguing with management why using blockchain is a mistake."
The New York Times published a report on recent advances in wind turbine engineering, And I definitely recommend checking out the story on nytimes.com. The link is in the episode notes, so you can click through after the show. The accompanying photographs and video are amazing, even if just to get a sense of scale of how big these things are. Reporters Tanley Reed, Karsten Snedberg, and Rasmus Denball give a history of the turbine industry, which flourished in the windy northern end of Denmark's Jutland Peninsula. The original blades, manufactured in the early 1970s, were just 15 feet wide, and now the rotor blades can reach 270 feet and weigh 30 metric tons, and the biggest turbines are over 600 feet tall. The industry has moved from a few small, local wind companies to being dominated by international giants like Siemens. Andres Nauen, the chief executive of the offshore wind division at Siemens Gamesa, notes that even though government subsidies for wind turbine development have mostly gone away, there's real optimism for new markets for wind power in Asia and in the U.S. Corey Klein wrote in a comment on Hacker News, "Selling solar back to the grid has one major problem that, fortunately, doesn't plague windmill installations. The duck curve. The problem is that peak energy usage now occurs after sunset. So no matter how many solar panels you stack on your home, around 6 to 7 p.m., the coal, oil, and gas power plants all have to spin up to their max capacity. Your solar panels are now less likely to replace a coal power plant, although they do change how many hours in a day it runs. Unfortunately for the power companies, running a coal power plant for 3 hours a day costs just about as much as running it for 8 hours a day. This leads to the power companies naturally feeling rather sour about being forced to credit residents for the power they supply to the grid during low demand hours. Their costs are staying about the same, but now their revenue stream goes down."
While Facebook has been through the ringer lately for privacy concerns, other major tech companies have gone relatively unscathed. A new article by the Wall Street Journal puts the spotlight on Google, with an article titled, "Who has more of your personal data than Facebook? Try Google." The article covers the many ways Google collects data on its users. Most people have some awareness that when they're using Google's search engine, Google is collecting information on them, including their past search history and what they click on. This data is part of what allows Google to tell that when I'm searching for the word Python, I want search results about the programming language, not the snake. Fewer may be aware that Google also extracts information from YouTube videos a user watches and then combines this data with its search data. Even fewer may be aware that Google, as of a policy change in 2016, then combines all of this information with data from its advertising business, a practice it had long suggested it would not engage in. The end result is Google now associates, though does not directly sell, identifiable user data with its advertising business. This marriage of data with advertising is exactly at the heart of Facebook's privacy issues. Further, while Facebook was ultimately put in the hot seat for serving up a platform on which app developers were able to collect user information, a la Cambridge Analytica, the Wall Street Journal points out that Google enables similar data harvesting on its Android operating system. Facebook itself benefited from this. Recent news stories highlighted how it was able to harvest users' call and text history on Android phones. Arvind Narayanan, a computer scientist and assistant professor at Princeton, says that the larger problem is that the very business model of these companies is geared to privacy violation. Google, in many ways, was the company that set the tone in this space with the outsized success of its advertising business. A generation of startup founders, including myself, started businesses in the age of giving a product away for free and then monetizing via advertising, just like Google does with its search engine, Gmail, and YouTube. If Google isn't doing enough to protect its users' privacy, it's almost certainly the case that most of the internet is not doing enough. As Hacker News commenter Nadia writes, "What I mean is Google provides the means, but Google couldn't track nearly half of all the sites if nearly half of all sites weren't complicit in the tracking."
A group led by scientists at Northwestern University, the Department of Energy's SLAC National Accelerator Laboratory, and the National Institute of Standards and Technology has reported a shortcut for discovering and improving metallic glass and hopefully other materials at a fraction of the time and cost. According to a release from Northwestern, metallic glass is an amorphous material whose atoms are arranged every which way, much like the atoms of glass in a window. Its glassy nature makes it stronger and lighter than today's best steel, and it stands up better to corrosion and wear. Although metallic glass shows a lot of promise as a protective coating and an alternative to steel, only a few thousand of the millions of possible combinations of ingredients have been evaluated over the past 50 years, and only a handful developed to the point where they may become useful. The research group took advantage of a system that combines machine learning with experiments that quickly make and screen hundreds of sample materials at a time. This allowed the team to discover three new blends of ingredients that form metallic glass, and to do it 200 times faster than it was done before. Hacker News commenter Plaid Fuji writes, "As a researcher in this field, I'll just add that in many cases, automating the sample prep and the characterization is a massive leap in and of itself, even without adding machine learning. It's truly a synergistic combination of advancements in both fields and has great potential for accelerated discovery." Did you know that 2018 is already 31% over? If you have this new app, you'd definitely know. It's called Progress Bar OS X, and it got over 750 upvotes on Product Hunt. It's pretty simple. It's a little icon in your menu bar that tells you how much of the day, month, and year has already progressed. The app was created by Andrei Asimov, who says he was inspired by the Twitter user Year Progress. Asimov recently quit his job to start what he's calling a hardcore year. He's giving himself a single year to become profitable as an indie maker. Fortunately for him, he says he's currently living in Bali, where he can live comfortably off of $1,000 per month. In a post explaining his hardcore year, he writes, "In Bali, $1,000 can pay for your rent, scooter, eating out three meals a day, and most importantly, all the coffee you could possibly drink." He's building in the open, posting his progress on his blog, and even sharing his revenue numbers. Check the episode notes for a link, and you can get the app for $5 at progressbarosx.com. That's all for Hacker Daily today, Tuesday, April 24th. This is our eighth real episode of Hacker Daily, and it's been an amazing journey for us so far. So we'd love to hear more from you, our listeners, about what's working and what's not working. Please send us an email at info@hackerdaily.co, or you can follow us on Twitter at HackerDailyCo. And we'll be back tomorrow with more news and updates for hackers, founders, and makers. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you have a great day.